All right, welcome to class. Before we dive in, I should just comment. One of the side effects of my recording my lectures and encouraging people not to show up is that my attendance only drops by like 30% the day before Thanksgiving. Before we dive in, are there any comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Yeah?
Could we look at some of the quiz?
Oh dear. Yes, we can do that. Instantly, starting 2 days ago, NetBadge will occasionally claim that your computing ID is the empty string. I've been using NetBadge for, about 7 years or something, and it just suddenly started. All right, what would you like to look at?
Can we look at the check all and apply?
Which of the following are shallow water equations able to capture? Big waves are fast waves, waves deflect around obstacles, the top of waves overtake the bottom, creating concavity and foam. Vorticity in water disturbs the surface behavior. What would you like me to talk more about?
I just thought that the shallow water would be we're just doing vertical bars or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That couldn't do waves that curve and stuff like that, which I guess intercede there, but I also thought it had to do with big waves or fast waves, and I didn't have any idea if they could deflect around obstacles like that.
Oh. We may not have talked about deflect around obstacles, and yet that's the one that has the highest correctness rate. We may have. I don't remember doing one with an obstacle.
One video that had a bunch of different simulations, and then they put stuff in the middle.
That may be.
That.
Yeah, maybe this was just a bad question, because we may not have talked about this enough to know the answer. But essentially, all that shallow water equations does is just ignores everything except the gross dynamics and a two-dimensional-ish space. Technically, it's actually a compressible fluid simulation, although that we didn't really talk about, so I didn't ask it. Right? But it still has, when you have a big, tall wave, you have a steeper slope, which causes a larger gradient, which causes a faster motion. And that will come out of this just automatically. You don't have to do anything special to make it happen.
That seems very different from the way that you described in the class where you're talking about how big waves are fast waves, and that's what makes it work.
So that is, it does not capture that part.
Yeah.
But it does capture the gross effect.
Yeah.
So actually that overtaking actually also depends on fluid friction against the bottom of the ocean. There's actually quite a lot of things going on for that overtaking. But just the idea that larger waves move faster comes out just naturally because you have larger deltas and longer for them to build momentum as they go. Yeah.
We go with our rope with the three.
The rope with the, where was that one?
Yeah. Question about shade.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right, consider a mass-bearing ball of rope with three masses, each connected to only their immediate neighbors. Using only local spring resolution, if one endpoint is moved a long distance... Wow, I don't know why I have hundreds in here. Oh, this is confusing. I originally said with 100 masses, and I apparently didn't finish changing the key. But anyway, the answer remains. These are really strange answers. using local only spring resolution, if one endpoint is moved to long distance and held there, how long will it take for the other endpoint to move to the same distance? Assume there's no gravity or other outside force being applied. So we talked about how the stream forces by themselves will never make this happen, but momentum still applies. It will take at most for three weights. It'll take at most three time steps for the last weight to start moving. And then if nothing else happened, you just have to wait. Right? Because once it's moving, it's moving. Right? This is why, for example, if you pull on a rope, the end can fly across the room, even though your hand didn't move that far. Right? This is probably not my best question ever, and it's made even worse by this random insertion of 100s instead of 3s. Oops. But so, as a consequence of that, it depends entirely on the spring constant. Because if you have a very stretchy rope, it'll take longer for it to speed up. If you have a very stiff rope, it'll speed up right away. Which nobody thought, which suggests that this was an even worse question than I already thought it was, just sort of mediocre to start with. So yeah, we may just drop that one.
What does move the same distance in this context?
One endpoint has moved a long distance. How long does the other one to move the same distance? There are only two distances mentioned, right?
Same direction also, or just like magnitude of distance?
The answer is the same either way.
So like to the spot that the other endpoint's at, or like?
No, distance. But actually the answer is even the same if we just say it's the spot the other one moved to.
Okay, that's curious.
Yeah.
I remembered in class you saying something about spring constants not being important. Do you remember what that was?
So how many time steps it takes to get to the end of the rope, the spring constant doesn't care. So we talk in class about how long before the end starts moving, before we see motion, right? We also talked briefly about how long before the rope is no longer stretchy. And we decided neither of those obviously have an upper limit on their time. Or right, one of them has upper limit on the number of steps, the other one is however long it takes for all of the springs to completely relax, unlikely to occur. Right? But how long does it take to move, which we didn't talk about, which is why this probably isn't the question I should have asked. Yeah. Sorry. I may just remove this question. Other questions about the quiz? Righto. Let me just, there was one other thing I wanted to, where were we? I have not started grading, I apologize. I have not started grading homework 4 yet. I just haven't had the time, but you know, I have several days of time coming up, hooray. Isn't that what you want to do on your Thanksgiving? Instead, you can work on the project. So I think I have been contacted by 3 people about doing a project other than the images, which is fine. Right, that's why we have a default project. But if you wanted to do one, the sooner you let me know what you want to do, the sooner we can try to make that something that's actually doable. So I just wanted to mention that is the case in case you had just forgotten to do that. All right. So let's go into destruction. That's an old version of the page. All right, I have 2 articles here on destruction. So we had several people say how do things break or shatter or so on that they wanted to talk about. This is, if we think of our conversation about fluids as the entire discipline of aerospace engineering and fluid mechanics and bioengineering, about a third of that, all wrapped up into 2 days. Here we have the entirety of material science and about half of mechanical engineering, right? And this is a common thread in graphics. We try to understand just enough about entire other disciplines to make cool pictures. So let's talk just sort of at the very highest level about how destruction ought to work, and then we're actually going to try to dive into a paper and talk a little about how to read a paper, because I feel like we should do that, and a lot of you felt like we should do that, and this is a reasonable if you ever do that in. All right. Let's suppose we have some object that we are tugging apart. Okay, there are certainly other ways we could apply force on this, but we're tugging it apart. That creates a stress, typically drawn as a sigma, because, well,
it's an S sound.
Yeah, sure. I mean, at some level, what happens is every field decides they want single letters or Greek letters for their things, and there aren't a whole lot of them. So sigma is also the standard deviation, right? And sigma, anyway, but stress, sigma, okay. So this is how much we're pulling apart. There's different kinds of stress to be in how it's pulling on the object. We'll start with this one because it's one of the easiest. This stress is counteracted by a couple of forces internally. We have the fact that different molecules are trying to pull themselves together. Okay, so they are attracted to each other by a spring-like force. The strength of that spring-like force is actually described by so many different constants depending on what approximation we use. But we'll call this, we're doing this with capital E, which clearly stands for Young's modulus. So much for the sigma posit theory, right? Okay, where this is named after a chap named Young, who came up with this. Modulus is just the diminutive of measure, right? So this is a little measure. I don't know why we call it a modulus, but we do. Anyway, this is sort of the bigger Young's modulus, the stiffer, the more it resists the stress. The Young's modulus version actually works in both directions equally, so it also resists compression. Then we also have this sort of volume preservation. Okay. And volume preservation, we've talked about a little bit in fluids. There's lots of ways of talking about how it happens. But essentially, as these molecules are forced apart, that sort of creates something like a vacuum, although not a vacuum form. It's not actually caused by air pressure, it's caused by potential. But it'll sort of pull the particles on either side in, which will mean that it will tend to, as it stretches out, shrink in the other direction. And that's also typically just described by Young's modulus, although there are other versions that will spread it out. Okay? And so this is, we put some tension on this, and it stretches out, but it doesn't stretch forever because molecules do not have infinite energy. There's only so much energy they can use to pull together. And if we can pull harder, then that energy will allow them to pull together, then it needs to break. Somewhere, some molecular bond in this needs to sever. And so it has to pick some place. So which molecular bond will sever first? There actually is an answer the way I drew the picture. Okay? And the way we can think about this is the force is going to be distributed across the area. So the wider it is, the more space there is, the more molecules there are to distribute, that share the load. And so an area where it's a little narrower, or maybe up here, I'm not sure what my narrowest point was, but my narrowest region is the most likely, it's going to have the most force per molecular bond, and therefore going to have the most stress per molecular bond, and therefore is going to rupture first. Except that totally isn't actually what happens. This is what we thought ought to happen, and the physics all works out, except materials are not nice, smooth, constant things. So back in World War I, there was a physicist or an engineer that started noticing that when you try to measure the strength of glass, it seems to be about 1,000 times stronger than it really is when you use it in the real world. It's like, where did 1,000 times of its strength go? And so started trying to understand this. And one of the studies that was done was, okay, well, let's make a little cut in the side of our object. That will force there to be sort of all of the forces that are pulling on all of this region, they all sort of have to pull around this corner. Okay? And the current model, when he started this experiment, said, oh, the stress around the corner ought to be infinite. That didn't seem to be the case, so came up with a whole different model of how we understand stress and fracturing that is actually based in a large part around the solid version of surface tension. And we could spend extensive time talking about how all of that works. But the basic concept is, any given molecule, it likes to be attracted to all of its neighbors. Okay. If it has the right number of neighbors, that's sort of what it likes. That's its lowest energy state. That's its default behavior, is completely surrounded. And if you remove a few of those, then it wants something there, and there is nothing there, so it's in a higher energy state. It tries to get out of the higher energy state by duplicating bonds, or by pulling in towards other things, or various other ways of handling this, based in this higher energy, less desirable state. This is what keeps solids from just evaporating. And so sublimation is what we call it when this is the other direction, where the surface has lower energy than being in the middle, and then it just poof turns into gas. But most things that we're used to being solids, they prefer to be in the middle than on the edge. And that prefer to be on the middle than on the edge gives us some additional forces that you can plug into all the formulas. And so if you want to see those formulas and a little bit of the history of some of these people, you can go to the Wikipedia article, which also has diagrams of the three main kinds of fracturing modes, stresses, depending on where the force is coming from, mode 1, 2, and 3, and then has histories of Griffith, who did this original work with putting a flaw, i.e. a giant cut, into glass sheets to measure how they behave, and all of the math, and then what Irwin realized they were wrong. What Irwin realized is that this only works for glass, but most stuff has this ductile or plastic behavior, where they can bend some like clay without fracturing and without reverting. And so what happens in most materials is sort of right around this very high stress area, the behavior of the material changes from being rigid to being plastic. And that causes energy to get lost and causes things to tear slower, okay? And so we have all of these equations have been studied over many years. And, you know, usually when people are studying these, it isn't to make cool videos. It's to do things like keep ships from tearing in half in the harbor, which has a slightly higher economic value, right? Or at least used to before. But this is literally just a ship where they didn't think carefully enough about how metal worked. And so it was just sitting in the harbor, and the stress in the middle got high enough, it just cracked in half. Right? And so this sort of thing where you have, you know, hundreds of people having worked for many hours, months, years even to build something and it just cracks in half causes people to pay attention quite a bit to how this all works. And there's, you know, tail fins coming off of airplanes and so on. There's a lot of reason why people are trying to do this to save lives. We're just interested in making cool effects when people shoot things in video games, right? So we're glad they did the work and we're going to ignore almost all of it. Because, you know, it just needs to look cool. There's a whole lot known about this space, right? We're not going to go into anywhere near the detail that we went into about fluids, both because we don't have the time, but also because we humans don't generally see as many solids failing to have a strong intuition about how they should behave, like, for example, liquids that they drink every day. As you can get it somewhat wrong, and it's very unlikely people are going to say, ah, that crack of glass looks wrong, because they don't really have a strong intuition. So we'll talk some about some of the papers, and then we'll also talk about what do we really do, because the papers are going to be a little slow. All right, so, yeah. Any questions about sort of the math of it before we dive into, let's look at actual paper? All right, what I'm going to do next is I'm going to take this particular paper. We actually saw an animation from this paper earlier when we were first talking about meshless systems. And I'm basically going to talk for more time than you thought about 2 or 3 paragraphs. We probably won't get much farther than that, okay? But I'm going to try to give you the tools you'll need if you ever decide, ooh, I want thin clay statues to break apart from the inside. How do I do it? Well, here's a paper that clearly did it because they have a picture right on the front of it happening. And how did they get there? They have the usual sort of what did other people do? And that's an important part of the paper, but not a part of the paper I want to spend a lot of time on. We will actually come and look at some of the related works, but in a different context. Most technical papers in CS, they start with the real stuff either in section 2 or 3. It's section 2 if the related works is part of section 1, otherwise it's section 3. Okay? And we always start with, here is the high level idea about how we ought to do something, or here is the math we used, here's the theory behind it. And then they'll move into, okay, but here's how we actually did it, and then into, oh, and it kind of worked. Right? This is the order of a paper. Here's our theory, here's our application, here's the results. So we're going to start in chapter 2, or section 2 of this paper, where they start by saying, we first give a brief review of the relevant equations of continuum mechanics and discuss the discretization in the meshless setting. Okay? So they're saying, hey, there's this whole field, continuum mechanics. We're just going to, like, give it to you in a paragraph or two. All right. So we're going to go through this and see if we can make sense out of it all. Any time you're reading a graphics paper, particularly simulation, but any one of them, they're going to find so many terms. You're going to need to make yourself a glossary. So we're going to make ourselves a glossary. All right, given a three-dimensional solid. All right, so we have some sort of, we know we're in 3D, we have some sort of solid. Great. They don't name it, that's just sort of the assumption. With material coordinates X, what do we suppose material coordinates means? Sure, there's some sort of coordinates X. Hopefully there'll be a clue later on. Okay? We're not even a sentence in and we're already lost. All right. We defined the positions of the deformed model in world coordinates as X plus U, where U is UVW transpose, is a displacement vector field. All right, we need to guess. We're not going to get much more than this. What do we think X and U mean? Yeah.
X is like where the, X is like a general term for some point in the model, and then U is like how far it's been exploded or displaced from its original position.
Yeah, so to use a model probably many of you are painfully familiar with right now, let's consider. Okay, this model has these coordinates, right? And so some point in that coordinate system off of the origin, that would be X. Okay? And then if this is not sitting at the origin, but for example has been put out in front of the camera by a model view matrix, for example, right? That position where it sits down there on the negative X axis, that offset would be U. Okay, and so then we're saying the position it actually is in the real scene as the camera is looking at it. Okay, that position it actually is out in the real scene, that's X plus U. And because, you know, we can, we have a bold U, which is defined as, how do they define the bold U? As a column vector written in row vector transpose with an italic U, V, and W.
Why don't they pick different letters?
Wouldn't that be nice? Except we don't pick different letters for X, do we? We would expect this to be X, Y, and Z. So they're being consistent. They're not necessarily being clever, but you know, they're doing what other people do. So, all right, great. So we have this displacement vector field where each point in the model goes. And notice this is assuming this is not rigid, right? So the U is not just a matrix. Each point could be distorted to a different location. Because for things to fracture, we typically need them to have some level of flexibility, at least in the intermediate state, right? It gets pushed out of place and that either pushes the whole model, creates an elastic thing, or causes a fracture. So each point can have its own U across the whole object. All right. The displacement induced by U creates a strain. What does induced mean in this context? Yeah, well, why did we say induced? Because we did. Anyway, right? Because we moved stuff, it's under strain. What is the definition of strain? Moved stuff. Okay, so this is almost tautological. It's designed in part to connect people that are familiar with different fields, to tell them how these terms intermingle, right? So we have U, which is this displacement vector field for the vector field people. It's a strain for the materials people. They're the same thing. Okay, but of course the displacement has things that aren't strain as well. So strain refers to being forced away from your neighbors or towards your neighbors. It's that thing that Young's modulus resists. Okay, and so we only want this local. So how do we find this? Well, we get it from the gradient delta U. All right, so we need to remind ourselves how gradients work. What does the gradient tell me? The partial derivative of what with respect to what? We're taking the partial derivative of U with respect to? Right, gradient is with respect to its own coordinate system. So what this really means, this is the gradient of U, but this really means like, is it squishy or stretchy? Okay? So the gradient will point towards, it'll point towards the squish and away from the stretch. Okay, we're taking the gradient of this field. How does it vary? So if it's all being pushed together, the points are pointing towards each other. Positive gradient. Pointing away, negative. So we have this this field of how squishy things are, how much they're being compressed. We solve that with the quadratic Green St. Vernon strain tensor as. Who knows what that means, right? I'm sure there's in disciplines that when they heard me say that, they'd be horribly offended. And if you've taken some of their classes, sorry. I don't really care who Green, Saint, or Venant were, or even how you say Venant, because this is just saying where we got the math, right? We're not really interested in keeping ships from cracking. We're actually interested in making them crack, right? So that they will look cool. So here's what they have here. They say, if you have the gradient, then you do this equation. Okay, you take this matrix and its transpose, and it times its transpose, divide it by 2. These are square matrices, hopefully, because otherwise I'm not sure you multiply yourself by your transpose, but the gradient should be square. Okay, so we have this thing that we create, and so let me get this. This is getting harder to write. Okay, that is the, in LaTeX that's called a var epsilon rather than a regular epsilon. I don't know how, anyway. I think they only use one epsilon in this paper. I could be wrong. So you have this epsilon, which is going to be the strain. Okay? So this is actually the strain. So we just said that strain means the same thing as U, but it's a little bit different. Strain is how much it's being deformed away from its neighbors. U is how much it's being deformed from world coordinates. So this is sort of the local version of U. Okay? So the local elements of U, how much it is locally internally. And we can create that. This is computed from that easily, as in just with matrix multiplication. We don't need to worry about solving some linear system. They've just shown us the equation. Hooray. And they showed us the equation. They didn't even number it. So that probably means we're never going to talk about it again. All right. So we have this equation. Assume a Hookean material. Yes?
So this might be explained later, but is the gradient like an input that they supply? Or do you somehow figure that out from someone else?
Yeah, so when they start by assuming we have the deformed coordinates U, presumably that means we're going to have some deformed model. We're going to push the points around. This is meshless, so assume there'll be a whole lot of points. And typically in meshless models, I assume that we're going to deform every point. That'll give me a U for every point. And then I go back and fix it so the physics works. I don't know that's what they're going to do yet. I mean, I know what they did because I actually read the whole paper, right? But we don't know that's what they're going to do yet. That's just sort of my assumption from it being meshless. And typically when they start with these pieces and they say, let's use them, we're going to assume they're inputs to some stage. So presumably, whatever force is knocking into things is giving us U. We're just going to push the particles out of the way. There we have U, and we'll work on from there. Yeah?
Thinking about that more the process of calculating the gradient from.
Oh, how do we compute the gradient?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Do you compute the gradient?
We do compute the gradient. And they're actually going to talk about how to compute the gradient down here, sort of. We'll get there. But they're just going to assume, however you're representing the material, I did the wrong button. We knew how to compute the gradient. This is actually fairly common. We assume you can find where the object went and how to find the gradient on it. And generally, how do we find gradients? We compare neighboring elements. If they're moving together, we have a toward together gradient. If they're moving apart, we have an apart gradient. How do we find neighbor? We'll get to that later. Smooth particle hydrodynamic kind of idea is likely to be the case. Other questions? Yeah?
Can you explain what meshless is?
We have a bunch of points that aren't in a grid and aren't rigidly connected to each other. Just a point cloud. Other questions? All right. Let's assume a Hookean material. Does anybody happen to know what a Hookean material is?
I assume Hooke's law.
Assume Hooke's law, which means?
Things that are displaced from the original point are linearly forced.
Yeah, this linear equation of springs. You don't have to know that, though. Anytime somebody says, assume a blah, 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 they always mean, let's pretend the world's nicely behaved. Okay? And this happens to be nicely behaved, and this is, right, we're just going to pretend like everything's linear is what Hooke actually believed. Hooke was wrong, right? But that's fine. We're just going to pretend it's simple, and we don't really need to know how they're pretending it's simple yet, unless we decide the results aren't good enough. Right? We assume a Hookean material, we get an elastic stress is related to strain as sigma equals CE, where C is a rank 4 tensor. What is a rank 4 tensor? That would be a 4-dimensional tensor. This rank 4 tensor, I believe, is just a matrix. I'm not certain, but I believe this is just a matrix. But they call them tensors, in, as I understand it, in some of the material science. So right, so we have this stress. Okay, so our stress equals a tensor, probably a matrix. But we don't really know that it's a matrix yet. Times that epsilon we created, which we knew was a matrix. Okay, so we have this behavior, and defines the constitutive law of the material. Question.
You just said that epsilon is a matrix, and I was wondering, like, how, just from that formula, like, how that even happens, like, if the gradient of U plus the gradient of U transpose, like, those aren't even symbolic.
Well, the gradient of a vector field is a matrix. And then I have to hope, right? I could guess any one of these. I'm taking transposes. That probably means I have a matrix. I'm adding them together. That assumes this must be square. I don't happen to remember if gradients are always square matrices, but I don't know how else to make this equation type check. So let's hope that's the case, and if it's not, we made a serious bloomer. Other questions? All right. So we also say that C is something that defines the constitutive law of the material. The constitutive law of the material. So this is defined by the material. That means we're going to have to look up what rubber has, or what stone has, or what glass has, or so on. Or hopefully, if we're lucky, somewhere later in the paper, they'll give us some example Cs. But presumably, this is defined external to what we're thinking about. Okay. Oh boy, more math. All right. The elastic force per unit volume at x can then be derived as F equals negative sigma delta subscript u epsilon. Nabla subscript u epsilon. All right, now here we have something you will find in a whole lot of graphics papers. A symbol that is never defined. Okay, what is a nabla subscript u? Not defined. We know what nabla u is. We don't know what nabla subscript u is. And so we could say, well, maybe this is a common symbol in multivariate calculus, because nabla is a multivariate calculus thing. Does nabla with a subscript have a multivariate calculus meaning? Does anybody happen to know?
I don't remember what it is.
Yeah, probably does. So we might have to look it up. We're hopefully though, they're going to derive past it. Okay, let's hope this is a temporary term they decide not to define because they don't need it. Say, so we have this, somehow we have this force per volume. Okay, the force per volume, they said that was, is equal to the negative of sigma, this undefined term, epsilon, where that was undefined. Hey, we might have to look it up. Maybe we won't need the force. Maybe they'll just use the force to decide if something breaks. We can hope. Okay? All right, so we have that. To discretize the force displace distribution, the displacement field U is typically approximated as... All right, now, when we say discretize, this is an important word. This means... Where did I just see it? To discretize. Discretize means turn into something a computer can use. We want to see this word. Okay? This means we're sort of leaving behind theoretic material science and we're moving into computers. We're turning into something we can handle. So we're going to pretend that U as a function of X is the sum over all I's of phi sub I X U sub I. All right, none of these terms are defined yet. But we can see that we are finding out the displacement for each point. Okay? And we have ui is the displacement vector to a discrete set of nodes. So we're going to define all of the displacements by saying we have a displacement at each discrete node. But we also have this extra term, this phi sub I of x. Phi sub I are the associated shape functions with those nodes. And then they say if we're FEM, FEM stands for finite element method. That means not a grid. Okay, so for non-grids, the phi I are constructed using a tessellation. What's a tessellation?
Mesh.
A mesh. All right, a mesh of the simulation domain into non-overlapping elements. All right, so saying finite element methods, that thing that engineers do, we aren't engineers, we're graphics, right? That thing that engineers do, they figure out what this multiplier is by breaking the universe into little cells around each point. So they're claiming that the approach for finite elements of how we find things is we have some little point xi that has some offset from where it started ui. And then we're going to use this, we're going to multiply somehow these two ideas. We're going to figure out the ui by multiplying this phi thing by ui. And that phi is going to be essentially the Voronoi region, if this is a finite element. We're going to find the area that's closer to this than it is to anything else. Okay? And take that region to do our work. However, when they say in finite element methods we do this, it doesn't really matter if they say in finite element methods. They just said in something, which probably means not in whatever we're doing. So let's see if we can find out what we're doing instead. Meshless methods require no such spatial decomposition. Hooray, we don't need a Voronoi diagram. Instead, use techniques such as moving least squares approximation. Here is who wrote about those. Okay, when you see a paper published in 2015 that cites 1981, it's always just to say, yes, yes, we know somebody did it early. Let's see what they're really doing. Okay, to define the finite functions based on location nodes only. Given a complete polynomial basis, oh, I don't like it when they say complete polynomial basis, we'll come back to that, of order n and weight function w, the mesh with state function, oh dear, and they numbered this, this must actually matter. Ah! Okay, all right, we're gonna figure out what this equation means. All right, let's figure out what the equation means. Okay, so, let's see, all right, let's see if I can write over top of it in some meaningful way. All right. So, they really care about this in some way, okay? So we have this that they're finding, we use that there. We use that there to find out U. We use U to find the gradient. We're getting back to how we find this gradient to start with, this question that you just asked. How do we define the gradient? We find the gradient by defining the function. How do we find the function? Using phi. How do we find phi? Here's our equation. It has the terms omega as a function of two things, p, which can be transposed, m in brackets, who knows what the brackets are for yet, and another p. Okay, so we have p. What is p defined as? P here, we see this is a complete polynomial basis. where they have x's here. We're going to assume these x's are the same x's we had up here. So they're taking 1 and x squared and x cubed and so on. How do you square or cube a point? Surprise, they don't tell us. Maybe. We're transposing it, and so it's suggesting that it's either giving us a scalar in each place, or they're all row vectors of the same, or column vectors of the same length. Dot product would be scalar, vector, scalar, and then what's the cubic term? All right, magic is happening. We'll come back to the magic. Let's see if we can figure out what any other piece of this means. Omega I is a weight function. A weight function of x and xi. Okay, wait. X was all of the positions. Xi was one of the positions. So we have some weight of all of the positions and one of the positions times some complete polynomial basis of all of the positions times m, which is the inverse of the moment matrix, which has those same terms in it. What is this doing? All right. This is the moment when I usually start thinking, oh, I hope I don't have to care. Let's skim ahead. All right. A decoiled account of how to construct shape functions from measureless methods can be found here. So somebody else wrote about how to get the W's or the omegas. The wave function omega plays an important role in this context. Oh no, we actually had to care. Oh wait, they're telling us what it is. Hooray. We use the compactly supported radial spine function. Here's a function. Yeah, great question. Where R is x minus y. All right, so we take two points, we subtract them, we find their length, so how far apart they are, divided by h, where h is support radius. Okay, this is starting to look like that sort of smoothed out idea we see for smooth particle hydrodynamics and for marching cubes and so on. This looks like something, if that's the case, this should be some sort of smooth function. So we're gonna try graphing this, which I think I did earlier. Let me see if I still have it up. Nope, I don't. Okay, so we're just going to go to Wolfram Alpha and we're just going to type the equation. Because, you know, I could do other graphing calculators, but I don't want to right now. All right, let me do a text selection, but this is not going to work. Ah, that's really not going to work. Let me do a table selection. There we are. All right, let's go in here. I needed some carrots. Oh, I know how to use my PDF viewer is basically how I did that. That would be Ocular.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so I'll just put this in and hope Wolfram knows what to do. Oh, look at this function. It's 1 up there. It goes down to 0 at 1. It has a bellish kind of curve on the positive side. This is a simple polynomial bell curve. Now I feel more comfortable we're on solid footing. We have a bell curve that we're using. We're figuring out its radius because that's the input here. We're dividing by something. We notice even above 1, we just set it 0, so we're clamping it to be a real bell curve instead of what it actually does. Okay, so we have this radial spline function. We're really just saying we're just smoothing them out to some function. Here's our function. So probably most of the rest of this is just a way of saying, how do you interpolate the neighbors? We might be missing something, but you don't immediately see things that look problematic with that. Okay, because we started by saying, we started by saying, how do we get the full function from a set of discrete points? So all we're trying to do in all of this is they're just trying to give us a mathematical derivation of how we smooth out a set of sample points into the whole function so we can find a gradient. So they've given us enough that we can wave our hands at that or use some other method we already know if we already know one. So they have something here about dynamically resampling. It depends on the density of the nodes. So they allow each one to have a different radius depending on how close the nodes are together. So we can have sparse and dense areas. They can resample that.
What is a node?
I'm guessing it's probably one of these points. Node is not the usual word for a point, but that's my guess. What do we call those things? Nodes, points, vectors, vertices. There's all kinds of names for them, but that's probably what they mean because they're sampling around them. And they even have these nice little pictures where they have something that looks like a color version of a support bar, a support region around. We'll have to figure out what the rest of this is doing later, but we'll get there. All right. They also directly apply the MLS procedure to the derivatives. That's the third time I've seen this reference. When you see the same reference over and over again, that's usually a sign, oh wait, here it is again. That's usually a sign they did most of the work being summarized here. So what we would do now if I really, really cared, because they seem to be hand-waving all of the details, is I'd either decide their equations as written are enough for me to work with, because they've given me omega, I know what the u's are, I know what the x's are. This equation, besides not knowing what a is, but wait, here's a, and it's terms of x's and the omega they gave me. All of these terms are defined. Hooray! Maybe I never needed to know what p meant. Okay? So I could just use these equations and ignore everything they said about p and the Knobla subscript u and all of those things. Or I could go say, well, what did Mueller say? I opened up Mueller's paper. Mueller has this paper about 11 years earlier about what you can do with Max Planck's bust. This is a very, I think all of the images in the whole thing are about doing weird things to Max Planck. Anyway, and so they have all of this stuff, and they go in some detail, and we'll see very similar. Oh, they actually tell us what these things mean. U's are displacement, Knobla U's are derivatives, epsilons are strains, sigmas are stresses, F's are forces, and we integrate. Whoa! Like they wanted us to understand. Maybe we should have been reading this paper from the beginning, right? But it's also a whole lot more work because they define so many more things. We have never seen J or I and all right. So there's a whole other paper we could dive into if we really want to understand what's going on. However, this paper doesn't give us what we want. It just shows us how to make Max Planck melt. That doesn't help us make things break apart. So this paper, I don't believe, has any picture of anything breaking. It does have a little bit of, like, let's make some wax melt. But mostly it's just, let's make things squish. And they even have a matrix of squishes. Anyway, this is an interesting paper in its own right. And probably a little bit more readable, although definitely more verbose. But this is sort of all saying, okay, we're using most of their stuff. They have stuff, it turns into this equation. Use that equation to find the derivatives if you need it. All of that gives us just, the derivative of V and W, but weren't V and W defined up here as being coordinates of U?
That's unbold U.
Right, we have an unbold, oh I see. So we have an unbold U, an unbold V, and so they're giving us an element-wise definition. Okay. Great. And they say this avoids costly computation. When? We need a first order accurate approximation scheme, so we use a linear basis. Oh great, we don't have to worry about any complex math. We can just say x is x. Okay, because we don't have to worry about how we square it. Even though they're symmetric, this is important. Even though they're symmetric and given an analytic form, the shape functions or approximant derivatives can only be used evaluated numerically. Evaluated numerically means you have to estimate. Okay? So they're not going to push through all the math. They're just going to use these equations. And fortunately, they just say, these are the ones we use. We just saw them. The second one is the first one, but computable. Hooray. And then they say, all right, how do these work? They're better than some other things, and we fix it a little bit. That was, what, three paragraphs? Two paragraphs? Paragraph one. Oh, actually, maybe we never made a new paragraph. That was all one paragraph. All right, that whole section is one paragraph. Okay. And what did we actually learn? We learned that we've thought about the physics, and these are the equations we're using. I'm not yet ready to put this in code. I guess I don't really know what's going on, but I can make a guess. I know how to find all the points in an object. I know how to find how they've been moved away from where they started. I know how to plug that into all of these equations, right? And so given all of those pieces, I've also noticed I've got an inverse here. That means I've got a linear system of equations to solve. So either this is a computable, but this is a matrix of all of the points. So I'm going to assume that means this is going to be a big sparse matrix. I'm going to use some sort of linear approximation system to handle. So I need to go pull up my conjugate gradient solver and figure out how to do this. Okay? And they're just assuming you figure that all out because they assume you've read a dozen other papers with matrices and you just know you're going to need conjugate gradient at some point. That's also why they have the words compactly supported. That means it doesn't go forever. At some radius, we stop. That forces our matrix to be sparse, which means we can solve it. Okay? So all of this is giving us just a linear system of equations that will find the stresses in the object. Given where all the points are displaced from, here are the stresses. And then they're going to go from there to, okay, but what about the fact there's a tear? How do we change all of these equations so that we work our way around the tear, so that the stress goes around the breaks? And so they're going to modify all of those equations in section 2.1. And once they have all of that, they're going to say, okay, now let's talk about how we actually do cracks. And they have some reasonable illustrations. We're going to say, all right, we know there's a crack. It can propagate. We're going to let all those points move as the stress pulls them. We're going to push them back onto the edge. We're going to resample because things move too far apart. And then we're going to make different kinds of nodes, crack nodes and gap nodes and solid nodes, and derive different laws of motion for each of them. So that as the thing pulls away, we can find the stress. As the stress gets too high, we can make them separate. And away we go. And then, you know, we only have 5 more pages to go through. But we can see, just glancing at the figures, you can learn some other things. Okay, they're having to change geometry. So you're going to have some kind of, oh no, I bumped into something, what do I do? That's going to be a whole lot of if statements. Probably 100 lines of code is just my guess. I haven't seen their code. But this kind of thing is complicated, as marching cubes gives us an example of. They have adaptive sampling. It's too slow. We put points everywhere. So we're just going to put them around the edges using a quad tree. Okay? Anytime you see adaptive sampling, it means it's too slow to work if you don't. That's the only reason we do it. Okay? And so they have, okay, here's how we're going to put our points. I'm not sure what C is about. We could read. Okay? And then they have rules about how you go back and forth, how you create cracks, how that changes where you put your points. So they're going to change how many points are on the cracks because that's the thing they really care about. And then they're going to get to pictures, right? So they go through all of how they do it, and then they finally say, hey, we actually did it. And it makes things that crack apart. Okay? So how long would it take to actually go through this properly? You know, days. If we wanted to build this ourselves, minimum of days to get all of the nuts and pieces, and then, of course, all the coding time. Okay? But this is the sort of approach that gets you through graphics papers. And very often, this process of saying, they keep citing the same other paper, let's go look it up, is the way you figure out the pieces they aren't saying. And then in this paper, who knows, there may be some other paper that they cite a whole lot. And so we need to look for that as well, right? And sometimes you have to work your way back. Fortunately in our field, you never have to work your way back before the 70s. Right? Really before the 80s, because that's when memory became cheap enough, frame buffers became possible, and graphics as we know it started. Right? So you've got 35 years maybe of papers to read through, at most. And usually 2 or 3 papers will get you back to the one that actually starts to introduce things. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yeah?
Is this going to be on the quiz?
I don't know what I'll write for the quiz after class today. Yeah. Maybe I should just jump to section 4 and say, what is C sub I plus 1? No. I mean, like, at some level, that is something you would need to know if you're really doing this. Unfortunately, it defined them as a set of surface cracks. Hooray! All right. Now, I don't know exactly what I'll say here. We'll probably talk mostly about what we're going to say for the next 20 minutes, because we're going to talk about how we really do this if we don't want to spend the time. All right. Questions about the paper before we go into fast approximations? Okay. I thought about just talking about fast approximations, but then I also thought about how do you find out what other people are doing. So let's just try randomly looking for YouTube of real-time shatter demolition and just see what we find. Oh, this looks positive. All right. Here is just a video of things falling apart. Oh, that's nice. They're throwing little balls at things and they fall apart. Okay? Now, the comments on this basically just say, hey, I did this. Because this is not a paper, right? This is somebody's personal show off. So let's see if we can talk about how just from a watching an image like this, we can get a feel for what they're doing. First thing, let's look at the chunks. What do you notice about the chunks? They're big. Sorry?
They're very polygonal.
They're very polygonal.
They have like cleaner cross sections.
Clean cross sections. Partly that's just to make it real time. Okay. Also, they're all convex. Right? They're either tetrahedra or cubes or like a couple of tetrahedra or pyramid-like thing poked together. Right? And as this thing falls, what it looks like happening, so I noticed that, and then if we look up here, it's kind of hard to see. Maybe we're going to need to turn down some lights. They're starting to reveal a little bit of the magic up here. There are little hairline cracks all the way up. What it looks like to me they did, I don't know. I literally just am in search for this and watched it, right? What it looks like to me they did is they just picked random like chops for the whole model all the way up. And then when you hit something, they're using probably some form of basic rigid body. It says this thing moved, make it start to fall, and work your way up to the earlier things. Why make these convex? Because then we can use the method of separating axes to find collisions efficiently. So you have a basic rigid body simulator. They have some kind of these things are stuck together, treat them as a single object. And some kind of force was applied here, break it away from the object. And that appears to me to be what's happening. You'll also notice they have things break instead of twisting. So they can actually make their physics simulator a little simpler. If we consider this situation right here, what ought to happen to this model? Should fall over, right? The vast majority of the mass is over here. But they're not treating the whole thing as a model. Their goal is to make things shatter, and I suspect the first time you glanced at this, the first thought you had was not, oh no, things aren't falling down. Because it's designed to distract you with what you care about, the things that are breaking apart. Okay? So the fact that there, once we collect that, it all shatters, hooray, that looks cool. And then they have like what happens if you put one thing on top of another thing, and right? And it has these nice behaviors. I mentioned, though, that some of them were convex, and it looks like I may have actually been wrong. It looks like there's some concavity. Nope, I can't stop. Okay. I just can't do that. All right, YouTube really, really, really wants to play the next movie. All right, like this over here looks sort of like concavity. I would guess those are several convex shapes that just haven't separated, that whatever their separation rules are, those are still stuck together. Because that would just make it easier for their collision resolution. Okay? So this is an approach. We could just chop things into pieces and use some sort of rule that says this one started moving, the one next to it didn't, break them apart. And this can give us convincing things are crumbling apart, I feel destructive kind of effects in our video games. Okay? Let's also, I spent a little bit of time before class looking for different ways. Why is this going so slowly? Come on. All right. Let's also look for, I think this is the one that worked. Yeah, all right. So there's lots and lots and lots of these pictures. Okay. So here somebody wanted to make a realistic animation of a bullet shattering a glass. Let's assume that the physics of figuring out where all these cracks should be is undoable. What do we do instead? If we want to make something that looks like that, but we don't want to compute the physics, what should we do? Yeah?
Just draw them and make it look good enough.
Yeah, I could literally just come down and get an artist to say, okay, cracks look like this. There's mostly radial things. They jiggle around a bit. There's some crosses, right? I could even take a picture of it, scan it, okay? And then I could just do the same thing we just did. I could break the object into these pieces and make them each move, okay? I could try doing something more procedural. Right? There's so many of these pictures. Some of them, if you look closely, you start noticing a little pattern about the shapes here. This is a Voronoi cell. Okay? One of the common ways of doing shattering glass panes, as it turns out, is you just create a whole bunch of points near the center and then sort of randomly fewer points farther out. And then you do a Voronoi diagram of that, and those are the boundaries. Okay? And because they're all close in, you're going to end up with these tiny little regions in here. Because they're spreading out, you'll tend to have more radial-ish looking things. You'll get these nice sharp cracks. And it'll tend to look pretty good for planar glass. Okay? If that's what you want to do. So you can just straight up fake it. Just decide this is what we want things to look like when we're done, and make it go. Okay? Or you can try to simulate the physics, or you can try some version in between. As we're thinking about the versions in between, let's talk a little about how we would do ripping paper. So paper is reasonably easy to simulate using mass spring models, like we talked about for cloth and rope. Right? So I'm going to simulate my paper with a whole bunch of points in some sort of either rectangular or triangular grid, all connected with these little springs in between. Okay? And I want to then sort of just apply some force and create a tear. And this is pretty easy to do. I just say if the spring stretches too far, delete the spring. Tears appear. Okay? And the mass spring model will give me most of what I want. However, I'm going to have a problem if this is what I do. The problem is going to be I'm going to get a unzipper-like tear. It's going to be perfectly straight. Because my points here, whatever one was bridging the gap, is always going to be the next one to tear. So I can either randomize my initial points and hope that it goes a little bit random, right? Create, instead of a regular grid of points, I can create some sort of random distribution and do a Daylight triangulation, connect them, for example. But there's actually been several papers that what they did was literally, they just, for every spring, randomly picked how stretched it had to be before it snapped. Okay, and this will give you this nice sort of jagged behavior, because that's sort of what's happening in paper. Paper is not a clean, smooth, uniform membrane. It's a whole bunch of little fibers matted together. And they're all pointing in different directions, they're all different strengths. And so we just literally add random. And how much random do we add? Enough until it looks like tearing paper. And there's no special criteria. We just tweak it until we get it to look right. And so there's actually been several papers. I found one back in, I think it was 88, that actually suggested this model as the way of making tearing paper, and even had suggested levels of randomness to use to make things look like newspaper as opposed to typing paper, right? And so, right, we can do these things as well. Yeah. All right. Thoughts, comments, questions so far? Okay. So there, I'm going to spend a little bit of time hopefully talking about how we do changes in topology, which is a bit of a trick here sometimes. Before I do that though, Is there anybody that has a particular example of things breaking they want us to look at and see if we can dissect? Anybody have something in mind where they know things break apart? Yeah?
Mirror's Edge, the game was like having a lot of its breaking.
Okay, let's see what they've got. Mirror's Edge?
Yeah.
Do we think any of these will actually have it?
Say glass break physics on the bottom. Yeah, bottom green.
Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. So let's zoom back here. First off, let's just look at what's sitting on the floor here. What do you notice about these little chunks of piece, these chunks of glass?
They don't look like they have volume.
They don't look like they have volume. What else? They're somewhat the same, but we've also got this high detail, this high range cracks across the surface. Probably a texture map to avoid huge amounts of geometry. Probably that's also why they don't appear to have depth. They may actually have depth. It turns out that flat glass is hard, kind of hard to see the depth of. They have different shapes here, okay, and little bits and pieces on the side. I don't know if they actually create a shell cell for each of these little pieces and had some rule, did it crack or not? That's sort of a reasonable simulation of safety glass, which has a high internal stress rate, so it tends to break into tiny little pieces instead of big pieces. But you see this, but actually as we watch it, okay, what about this animation is going to make this easier to do? Okay, we just saw something break. We saw some more things break, some more things break. Why do I think that this, the way this runs is going to make our lives easier? Are they going to break more things? I don't know. Probably not. Okay, that was it. You don't care about them, you're not looking at them, and they move really fast. All right, look at this moment. We threw something through the window. What does it look like? Poof. Right? Now, somebody somewhere is probably going to sit and try to like freeze frame it and say, oh, that's pretty good. So you don't want to spend some effort on it. But often in a game, particularly a fast-paced action game, you don't really need it to look great. You just need it to not look bad. Right? You need the details that exist to be consistent, but you don't need all of the details to be there. Right? And so that is a nuance that shows up over and over again in real time. Is how do we only show things that you will think are consistent and avoid showing too much? This applies to texture maps. How do we make the texture maps not be really high resolution but still look good enough? It applies to frame rates, it applies to shattering, it applies to everything we're doing. We want them to give you room to believe something interesting is happening. Another thing you'll notice here is there's no large scale system, right? If you blow out a window of a high rise, what happens next? I doubt any of you have actually done this, have you? Yeah, it turns out that high rises have really strong pressure differentials between the inside and outside. Because there are these big shapes at what the, against the outside of which the wind is moving quickly, which creates a fairly large Bernoulli principle. They're more connected inside than outside, so they tend to have equalized pressure inside, not outside. They tend to have high power HVACs, so they tend to be pressurized. I don't know whether it's all going to blow in or blow out, but it's not just going to sit there, right? It's possible that you just happen to have that perfect day where the pressure outside is the same as the pressure inside. But when you think about how strong air pressure is, right, 32 pounds per square inch, if we only have a 1% difference, that's still 3 pounds in every square inch of glass, which weighs very little. And so they will just, they'll blow in or they'll blow out and they'll probably tear a part of the window with them, okay? Unless it happens to be a calm day and everything happens to be equalized, and maybe we just hope the weather's very nice outside, right? But we don't need that because none of you knew what to expect, right? We just need it to look like you smashed something through the window. And so we're good enough, right? And that's often the trick in games. We want to make it good enough. We want people to say, wow, that's cool, and then stop. so that we can say, wow, that's cooler, 3 years later with something better. Any other breaking things you would like us to talk about? All right. Let me talk just a little bit about, wow, why is my computer freezing up when I try to change tabs? Okay, let's just close this all together. Let's talk just a little bit about the challenge of topography change. When we break things, and some other times when we're sculpting or the like, we have this big problem, and let's just take a simple example of the problem. Let's assume we have just a slab. And let's assume by some means, I don't know, maybe we're like shooting some sort of blowtorch at it or something, we're melting a hole in the side. Okay? Initially, we can do that just by moving all of this surface stuff inside, and we can make a dent. Dents are pretty easy. But at some point, we're going to hit that magic moment when the dent would touch the far side. And when that happens, we have to change the connectivity of our mesh. Okay? And so this is a big challenge we often have if we're trying to really realistically do fracturing. We don't pre-compute the fracture lines. We figure out where they go. We have to re-mesh everything. And in principle, that would mean we need to make new texture maps for it. We need to figure out what's on the inside, right? And so how do we create these things? In some of these simulations, we will talk about what we call watertight surfaces. A watertight surface is one that could hold water, in theory, right? Where it's entirely enclosed, there's no overlaps, there's no holes. How do we create these? There are a lot of different approaches, but basically what we need to do, if we think in the 2D of this same thing, right? We're melting the hole. At some moment, we have to decide one surface intersected another surface. And we have to redo all of the geometry when that happens. So as we go from this to this, right, we had to change the geometry. And we did that typically by detecting that we would have crossed over. This is a version of collision detection. It's a surprisingly expensive version of collision detection. We don't get convexity. We can't deal with just balls very well. All the standard accelerations don't work super well. We can do some sort of fixed grid or octree or something. We're going to need quite high resolution because typically you want to sample these surfaces at high resolution with large areas with nothing in them. So octrees or quadtrees can work better than a fixed grid. But it can be fairly difficult to do this. And this is often something that papers will just hand wave over. It's part of the point of mesh-free simulations, like the paper you're just looking at. We don't even try to store this. We say instead, there is just a bunch of points, and some of those points are getting closer to each other than other points are. And then we can just simply decide whether we want to skin it after the fact using some sort of, when we decide the skin, we decide whether we make a hole or not using something like marching cubes. But that will tend to make things look sort of soft and gooey, okay? And so these mesh-free simulations can work pretty well, but will tend to make things look a little bit round around the edges. It's hard to do crisp edges on that. And if we want to do other systems, we have challenges about how we do this collision detection. Collision detection is all over the place in graphics. It's the basis of ray tracing. It's the basis of physics. Of all the different kinds of physics we've dealt with, except for fluids, right? But for fracturing, for rigid body dynamics, we always are caring about what can intersect what. And so we end up spending a lot of time saying, does this line touch this triangle? Yes or no, right? And trying to make ways of making that faster so this can work. There is, just as a random aside, there is actually a provably optimal way of doing this in 2D, but it's not optimal in 3D. The provably optimal way of doing this in 2D is that you create the Delaunay triangulation of the surface points, And then that turns out to have various nice properties, or the circumcenters of the Daylight triangulation will have various properties. And anyway, this works very well for 2D. It's sometimes used in image segmentation. Fairly rarely used in graphics, at least yet, because the 3D version of Daylight triangulations are not very robust. But yeah, that's the time we have. I will see all of you in a week, I suppose.